It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about how technology and a crowded planet will change almost everything we know about getting from point A to point B. And our first story begins about half a century ago.
Dans les deux oreilles, a priori. Donc ça a l'air mieux. On va voir par rapport à vous, mais là ça a l'air bien.
Was there like a moment when you knew that you wanted to explore the skies?
Yes, a very precise moment. That was in July 1969.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
This is Bertrand Piccard.
I am at the same time medical doctor and explorer and...
In July 1969, the Apollo 11 launched to the moon. Bertrand Piccard was 11 years old at the time, and he was there to see it happen. And that launch, it wasn't Bertrand's first.
Exactly. I was fortunate enough to see six Apollo take off.
We have ignition.
Apollo 7.
Liftoff. We have
8.
We have liftoff.
9.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.
10, 11, and 12.
Liftoff. 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 We have liftoff. 11:22 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
So how does an 11-year-old get to witness six Apollo takeoffs? Well, Bertrand's dad took him because he was an explorer, too. He was a deep-sea submarine diver. And that same week as Apollo 11...
My father started his dive in the Gulf Stream with a submarine he had built. There was a crew of six people, and he made a drift mission underwater from Palm Beach, Florida, to New Scotland.
Which is also known as Nova Scotia. Anyway, Bertrand's dad, Jacques, was also the first man, along with Don Walsh, to reach the bottom of the Marianas Trench. More people have walked on the moon than have been to the Marianas Trench. It's the deepest underwater spot on Earth. And Jacques' father, Auguste?
My grandfather made the first flight ever into the stratosphere, and he invented the pressurized cabin, and he was the first man to see the curvature of the Earth with his own eyes. And you know what is so strange is to see that he made his first flight in the stratosphere with a tie. He had a jacket and a tie. No flying suit.
So it must have been incredible to grow up like this, I mean, around those guys.
You know, what was really strange was the fact that as long as it was inside my family, I thought it was normal. So there was no limit for me between my dreams as a child and the reality that I could see through all the people I met.
Okay, so back to that week in July 1969. Bertrand's dad, fresh off his undersea mission, wanted his son to see the men who were headed to the moon.
And I met most of the astronauts also the evening before.
And you were just a kid.
Yeah, I was 11 years old. But you know, it's a fabulous moment where you open yourself to the world because you know at that age you still have everything to learn. So you're very receptive to everything. And it was so fascinating to see these 2 feats of exploration down and up in the same week. And I thought that's the type of life I would like to have.
So that's the type of life he chose.
Two Europeans attempting to go around the world in a balloon have broken the record for the longest flying time by a hot air balloon without refueling or stopping. Brian Jones of England and Bertrand Piccard of Switzerland.
In 1999, 30 years after he watched Apollo 11 go to the moon, Bertrand and Brian Jones became the first men to circle the globe in a hot air balloon. It took them 20 days. They flew as high as 37,000 feet and as fast as 160 miles an hour. And the pressurized capsule that they traveled in, it now sits at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., right next to the Apollo 11 command module. And at a press conference after he landed, reporters asked Bertrand.
Several people have asked what you will be doing next, and should there be other around-the-world balloon missions? Would you all comment on that?
Well, a lot of people say that it's the ultimate flight and there's nothing left. Probably the people said that after the Wright brothers' flight.
And just like the Wright brothers' flight eventually led to transatlantic travel and jet airplanes, Bertrand's balloon trip was actually the start of another mission, a mission that could change the way we all travel. Here's Bertrand telling a story from the TED stage.
Well, the unknown is part of life. And in that sense, ballooning is a beautiful metaphor. Because in a balloon, like in life, we want to go in a direction, but the winds push us in another direction, like in life. And as long as we fight horizontally against life, against the winds. Life is a nightmare. When Brian Jones and I were flying around the world, the weatherman asked us one day to fly quite low and very slow. And when we calculated, we thought we're never going to make it around the world at that speed. So we disobeyed. We flew much higher and doubled the speed. And I was so proud to have found that jet stream that I called the weatherman and I told him, hey guy, don't you think we're good pilots up there? We fly twice the speed you predicted. And he told me, don't do that. Go down immediately in order to slow down. And I started to argue. I said, I'm not going to do that. We don't have enough gas to fly so slow. And he told me, yes, but with the low pressure you have on your left, if you fly too fast, in a couple of hours, you will turn left and end up at the North Pole. And then he asked me, and this is something I will never forget in my life. He just asked me, you're the good pilot up there. What do you really want? You want to go very fast in the wrong direction or slowly in the good direction? And this is why you need weathermen. This is why you need people with long-term vision. So we went down, actually. We slowed down. And we went through moments of fears because we had no idea how the little amount of gas we had in the balloon could allow us to travel 45,000 kilometers. But we accepted to have doubts. We accepted to have fears. And actually, this is where the adventure really started.
Which brings us back to Bertrand's idea for the future of transportation, because on that flight, that balloon flight in 1999, somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, Bertrand and his partner, Brian Jones, were struggling to find the jet stream that would take them across the ocean, and they were burning way too much fuel.
We were a little afraid, Brian and I. We talked about it, had the butterflies in the stomach.
So this is audio from a recording Bertrand made inside the capsule at the time, drifting over the ocean. And when they finally touched down in the Egyptian desert after 20 days...
It's fabulous. Thank you.
Bertrand and his partner looked at a line of frost on their last fuel tank, and they realized just how close they came to not making it.
That's how much fuel we've got left.
After three weeks. And 40,000 kilometers.
What a wonderful piece of planning on our behalf.
So it was almost empty when you landed.
Yeah, absolutely. There were probably two more hours of duration after 20 days of flight.
When I saw that, I made a promise to myself. I made the promise that the next time I would fly around the world, it would be with no fuel. Independent from fossil energies. In order to be safe, not to be threatened by the fuel gauge. I had no idea how it was possible. I just thought, it's a dream, and I want to do it. And when the capsule of my balloon was introduced officially in the Air and Space Museum in Washington, together with the airplane of Charles Lindbergh, with Apollo 11, with the Wright Brothers Flyer, with Chuck Yeager's X-1, I had really a thought then. I thought, well, the 20th century, that was brilliant. It allowed to do all these things there. But it will not be possible in the future anymore. It takes too much energy. It will cost too much. It will be prohibited because we'll have to save our natural resources in a few decades from now. So how can we perpetuate this pioneering spirit with something that will be independent from fossil energy?
Pioneering spirit for me means to observe what we have learned to do and what we have learned to think and to believe and try something else. It's an active, disruptive behavior from what we have learned to what we would like to achieve.
And that disruptive thing for Bertrand? An airplane that flies day and night, entirely on solar energy. He's already flown it across the U.S. And next year, over the course of 5 months, Bertrand Piccard plans to fly that plane. It's called the Solar Impulse. He plans to fly it around the world. And he wants to prove that a new revolution in transportation technology is actually within reach.
So the idea is that if we fly around the world in a solar-powered airplane, using absolutely no fuel, nobody ever could say in the future that it's impossible to do it for cars, for heating systems, for computers, and so on and so on. And this is exactly the symbol of our world. If our airplane is too heavy, if the pilot wastes his energy, we'll never make it through the night. And in our world, if we keep on spoiling, wasting our energy resources, if we keep on building things that consume so much energy that most of the companies now go bankrupt, it's clear that we'll never give the planet to the next generation without a major problem. So you see that this airplane is more a symbol. I don't think it will transport 200 people in the next years. But when Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic, the payload was also just sufficient for one person and some fuel. And 20 years later, there were 200 people in every airplane crossing the Atlantic. People will tell you it's impossible, and it's exactly why we try to do it.
And in 50 years, if we still need to use fuel, air travel will be in trouble, really in trouble, because we'll be in a world of renewable energies where there will be either a lot of restrictions and regulations about fossil energy, or maybe just a price of fossil energy that will be so high that people won't use it anymore.
Do you see, like, can you imagine a future where we get around, either locally or transcontinentally, like through solar power? Like, solar power will generate the energy to move us around?
I would be crazy to say yes and stupid to say no. Because today we don't have the technology to move everybody on solar power. But don't forget, when Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic, he was alone on board. And we had to wait for maybe 25 or 30 more years before they could be commercial airliners. So we just have to insufflate the pioneering spirit, which means to open new doors. We have to understand now that we have to be open to change. All the people who fight to keep their old technologies are people who will disappear.
Bertrand Piccard's talk can be found at ted.npr.org. You can also check out what his team is up to at solarimpulse.com. Our show today, Transport for a Crowded Planet. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, getting there, ideas about transport for a crowded planet. So think about where you live, and think about never going more than 25 miles from where you are right now, ever.
Everybody.
Because for most of human history, that was the way it was.
I'm talking about the new Ford, and boy, it sure's a wow.
Until Henry Ford started to market the Model T to middle-class Americans.
Henry's made a lady out of Lizzie.
So what this really allowed people to do is to have freedom. It was really a societal shift.
This is Bill Ford, Henry Ford's great-grandson.
My two great-grandfathers were Harvey Firestone of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company and Henry Ford. And so in many ways, my parents' marriage was more like a merger. But
Bill is the executive chairman of the Ford Motor Company, and he was practically bottle-fed motor oil from birth.
Well, you know, I keenly remember when I was little, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, staring out the window waiting to see what my dad was going to bring home that night. And then when he brought it home, I would leap out the front door and go through the car, probably flying from the front seat to the back seat and vice versa, checking it all out because I was really interested in it. And I remember when he brought home the first Mustang, I thought that was about the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Was that strange? I mean, did you feel, I don't know, like pressure to live up to that legacy?
To me, it was something I was exceptionally proud of, something that I knew a lot about. But I also tried not to let it burden me in any way, and rather than that, actually have it inspire me.
And the way Bill Ford wants to make his mark is by changing everything about the way we're going to drive. Here's his idea from the TED stage.
By birth and by choice, I've been involved with the auto industry my entire life. And for the past 30 years, I've worked at Ford Motor Company. And for most of those years, I worried about how am I going to sell more cars and trucks. But today I worry about what if all we do is sell more cars and trucks? What happens when the number of vehicles on the road doubles, triples, or even quadruples? When we look at the population growth in terms of cars, it becomes even clearer. Today, there are about 800 million cars on the road worldwide. But with more people and greater prosperity around the world, that number is going to grow to between 2 and 4 billion cars by mid-century. And this is going to create the kind of global gridlock that the world has never seen before. Now, think about the impact that this is going to have on our daily lives. Today, the average American spends about a week a year stuck in traffic jams. And that's a huge waste of time and resources. But that's nothing compared to what's going on in the nations that are growing the fastest. Today, the average driver in Beijing has a 5-hour commute. And last summer, many of you probably saw this, there was a 100-mile traffic jam that took 11 days to clear in China. In the decades to come, 75% of the world's population will live in cities, and 50 of those cities will be of 10 million people or more.
So in your talk, you describe this traffic problems around the world, and you mentioned Beijing, and I heard that, and I thought, wow, I mean, like a 5-hour commute in Beijing on average. I mean, this is happening now, and we're getting to a future where, I guess, where cities just won't be able to absorb the number of cars coming in.
Yeah, it's happening. And what's happening as a result is a lot of municipalities are trying different kind of Band-Aids to ameliorate the problem. But frankly, all of those are just Band-Aids. And if you play that out, it becomes a human rights issue. If you can't deliver health care and food in major city centers because traffic simply can't move, that's a huge issue. Right now, people are looking at it as an annoyance, and it is. But it could get a whole lot worse. So the option of doing nothing, to me, is not an option.
So what's going to solve this? Well, the answer isn't going to be more of the same. My great-grandfather once said, before he invented the Model T, if I had asked people then what they wanted, they would have answered, we want faster horses. So the answer to more cars is simply not to have more roads. When America began moving west, we didn't add more wagon trains, we built railroads. Today, we need that same leap in thinking for us to create a viable future. We are going to build smart cars, but we also need to build smart roads, smart parking, smart public transportation systems, and more. We need an integrated system that uses real-time data to optimize personal mobility on a massive scale without hassle or compromises for travelers. And frankly, that's the kind of system that's going to make the future of personal mobility sustainable. Now, the good news is some of this work has already begun in different parts of the world. The city of Masdar in Abu Dhabi uses driverless electric vehicles that can communicate with one another, and they go underneath the city streets, and up above you've got a series of pedestrian walkways. Now, if you look at Hong Kong, they have a very interesting system called Octopus there. It's a system that really ties together all the transportation assets into a single payment system. So parking garages, buses, trains, they all operate within the same system. These are all really good ideas that will move us forward. Now, every morning, I drive about 30 miles from my home in Ann Arbor to my office in Dearborn, Michigan. And every night I go home, my commute is a total crapshoot. And I often have to leave the freeway and look for different ways for me to try and make it home. But very soon, we're going to see the days when cars are essentially talking to each other. So if the car ahead of me on I-94 hits traffic, it will immediately alert my car and tell my car to reroute itself to get me home in the best possible way. And these systems are being tested right now, and frankly, they're going to be ready for prime time pretty soon. So just imagine, one day, very soon, you're going to be able to plan a trip downtown, and your car will be connected to a smart parking system. So you get in your car, and as you get in your car will reserve you a parking spot before you arrive. This is the kind of technology that will merge millions of individual vehicles into a single system.
You can imagine the possibilities, right? Like the end of drunk driving, or the end of automobile accidents, the end of traffic.
Well, and think about old people who today have to give up their driver's license.
Yeah.
Now we can extend their life in a vehicle and make them much more independent. And then, you know, people who are disabled. I mean, there are so many really interesting aspects to this. And that to me is so exciting because one of the thoughts that Henry Ford had and that really drove him was this notion of opening the highways to all mankind. Well, if you play that forward, if you do allow seniors to drive longer, if you do allow disabled people to have access to mobility, you don't have drunk driving, you once again are now opening the streets to all mankind again.
Will everything we think about driving today be completely different in 50, 100 years?
Yeah, it certainly could be, and I wouldn't put it even at 100 years. I mean, I think, you know, we're talking really the next 10 to 50 years, and the reason I picked that time frame is a lot of the autonomous driving features are going to be coming in well within the next 10 years. And then beyond that, though, it's going to take a little longer to really figure out one system that everything is connected to. That'll take a little bit longer, but that's where we have to go so that every transportation element, whether it's a bike, buses, taxis, trains, subways, private cars, they're all going to have to be on a single network eventually.
We're on our way to solving, and as I said earlier, I know we've got a long way to go, the one big issue that we're all focused on that threatens it, and that's the environmental issue. But I believe we all must turn all of our effort and all of our ingenuity and determination to help now solve this notion of global gridlock. Because in doing so, we're going to preserve what we've really come to take for granted, which is the freedom to move and move very effortlessly around the world. And it frankly will enhance our quality of life if we fix this. Because if you can envision, as I do, a future of zero emissions and freedom to move around the country and around the world like we take for granted today, that's worth the hard work today to preserve that for tomorrow. I believe we're at our best when we're confronted with big issues. This is a big one, and it won't wait. So let's get started now. Thank you.
Bill Ford, he's the product of a family merger and the executive chairman of Ford. You can find his full talk at TED.com. So not too long ago, Robin Chase was at a transportation conference, and she was sitting on a panel with a bunch of experts in the field.
With the Commissioner of Transportation for London.
The head of a German car company.
The head of this European oil company.
And Robin, who's founded several transportation companies of her own.
And this audience member asked, what is the future of cars?
Not a trivial question.
And one by one, they were all, you know, saying whether it was going to be a hybrid car, whether it was going to be a big car, a square car, whatever. And I was literally jumping out of my skin. And finally, it was my turn. I said, no, the future of cars is shared cars. And to my huge pleasure, every single one of the other panelists turned and said, yeah, she's absolutely right. The future of cars, shared cars.
Meaning at some point, many of us will stop owning cars. We'll just share them with a bunch of other people.
If we think the future is urban, there is just no way in hell it's going to be anything besides shared cars, period.
Now, there are all kinds of car sharing services now where you rent by the hour, even by the minute. And Robin founded one of the best known of those companies, Zipcar, which she talked about on the TED stage.
I pay only for what I need. All those hours when a car's sitting idle, I'm not paying for it. It means that I can choose a car exactly for that particular trip. I can take a BMW when I'm seeing clients. I can drive my Toyota Element when I'm going to go on that surfing trip. Not only do I have a fleet of cars available to me in cities around the world that I can have at my beck and call, but heaven forbid I would ever maintain or deal with the repair or have anything to do with it. I get all the good stuff and none of the bad.
So why do you think this is going to be the future of driving?
You know, one of the really interesting things we discovered with Zipcar is how people change their driving habits relative to when they own a car. When you own a car in the United States, according to AAA, it's $9,000 a year. No one wants to believe that, but that's solid AAA data. And you as a car owner really are thinking that the price of this trip is really just the price of gas, right? So you think to yourself, I'd like some ice cream. And so you jump in the car and you go drive and get some ice cream. what we find when you don't own your car, when you're going to have to pay for it by the hour, that's $8 to $12 an hour, depending on what kind of car you're driving and where it is. And suddenly you're thinking, wow, $8 an hour, I'm not going to buy my ice cream that way. I'm going to, you know, stay home and eat these old cookies, and on my way home from work tomorrow, I'll buy some ice cream on the way home. When you own a car and it's parked up front, you never make that decision. You get in the car every time.
Each Zipcar replaces 15 personal cars, and each driver drives about 80% less because they're now paying the full costs all at once in real time. Now, a decade later, it's really time to push the envelope a little bit. And so a couple years ago, I moved to Paris with my husband and youngest child, and we launched Buzzcar.
Elle a mis sa voiture sur le réseau Buzzcar.
Buzzcar lets people rent out their own cars to their friends and neighbors.
J'ai craqué pour Julien. Enfin, c'est décapotable.
With Buzzcar, you independently can say, I want to share a car, and I want it right in this neighborhood. And so you can share your own car with other people, or you can go ask your neighbor's got a car and said, hey, if you put in this network, it's completely insured and the transaction effort has been minimized. So we as individuals can, in our own power, with our own agency and our own decisions, make car sharing happen.
Okay, but Buzzcar is only in France, right? So, I mean, so when you started it, were people saying, yeah, sure, you know, French people might share their cars to, you know, with total strangers,
mm-hmm.
but Americans will not do it. I mean, cars are like our individuality, right? I mean, their identity, like our freedom.
They did all tell me that. Then when I went to France, they would say to me, oh, but Robin, you don't understand. We French people, we have a special relationship with our car. We, you know, our egos are bound up. And I would look at them like roll my eyes, say, I've heard that one before. And can you honestly tell me that you think that Europeans have a more special relationship than Americans with their cars?
We launched. It's an exciting moment. And all the owners are adding their cars. It's really exciting. All the drivers are becoming members. It's excellent. A driver was telling me that they went to rent a car to go off the coast of France, and the owner gave it to them and said, you know what, here's where the cliffs are, and here's all the beaches, and this is my best beach, and this is where the best fish restaurant is. Peers and owners create relationships. And so on the last minute, people can, and a driver can say, hey, you know what, I really need the car. Is it available? And the person will say, sure, my wife's at home to go pick up the keys, go do it. And it's a kind of wow, and I want to say wow type of thing that's happening here. You have tens and hundreds and thousands of people who are creating experiments on this model. And so out of all that influence and that effort, you are having this exceptional amount of innovation that is coming out.
You know, another thing I've noticed lately is a lot of people like, are sharing rides, not just the car,
right?
I mean, like you go online and you find out if somebody's going to the same place you're going to, and then you sign up and then you're off.
Exactly. And putting humans and community into the mix makes it more humane, more fun. I do think that.
And so when I think about the future, people will be thinking that sharing the ride with someone is this incredibly great social event out of their day. You know, how did you get to TED? You went with other TEDsters. How fabulous. Why would you ever want to go by yourself in your own car? How did you go food shopping? You went with your neighbor. What a great social time. You know, it's going to really transform how we feel about travel, and it will also, I think, enhance our freedom and mobility. You know, where can I go today and who can I do it with? Those are the types of things that you will look at and feel.
All right, but I have to say, I mean, I'm listening to that and I'm thinking, I need my personal space.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to go shopping together with my neighbor every day?
When you do the shared cars, there's almost always an etiquette going on. And there's a company in France called BlaBlaCar, and they are now the largest ride-sharing company in the world. And the driver gets to indicate, I'm blah, or I'm blah, blah, blah. So that if you wanted to be in the car where no one is talking, you would say, I'm blah. Or if you are the person who doesn't stop talking, like my mom, you might be blah, blah, blah.
You can imagine, like, the awkwardness, though, if you go into a car and the dude's like, yeah, I'm blah. And then it's just silence for, like, 4 hours.
But it's not awkward. It's not awkward.
It would be weird. It's awkward.
It's just like getting on a bus. You get on the bus, you don't talk.
I mean, some people, like, hear this and say, I mean, this just sounds great, Robin, but, I mean, some of this just doesn't seem realistic and maybe even a little utopian. And, you know, people like their cars, and this is just going to be a tiny little kind of niche thing.
I think they thought that in 2000 when we launched. And I think what Zipcar showed is that actually mainstream Americans find it dramatically better. And what I know today is, yeah, I was right, that every single car manufacturer has a shared car pilot or company that they're playing with, every single one. So if you live in a city and don't need a car to get to work, you are crazy to be owning one. And as we all move to cities, we should not be owning cars.
Robin Chase, founder of Buzzcar and Zipcar. Check out her entire talk at TED.com. More ideas on transport for a crowded planet are show today. Getting There, I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, Getting There, ideas about transportation for a crowded planet. And in the U.S. and around the world, two numbers have gotten a lot bigger in the past decade. The number of people living in cities and the number of people getting around those cities by bike. How long have you been a bike rider?
Oh, pretty much since I learned.
This is Jeanette Sedek-Khan, and she served as Michael Bloomberg's transportation commissioner in New York City. And sometimes she bikes to work, and sometimes she doesn't.
I do drive, and I do bike, and I do take the train, and I do take the bus. And like a lot of New Yorkers, you know, I'm really happy about the fact that in this city, there are so many choices to get around town. And I think that's what people want. People want choices. It's not about one mode over the other. It's not about bikes over cars, over buses, over pedestrians. It's about providing the options that people need.
So if you've noticed more bike lanes or wider sidewalks, or just a better flow around your city, some of that may have been inspired by what Jeanette did in New York. She made it easier to get around. And other cities around the world are watching. Here's how she starts her TED Talk.
We live in an urban age. For the first time in history, most people live in cities. And the UN estimates that over the next 40 years, the population is going to double on the planet. So the design of cities is a key issue for our future. Mayor Bloomberg recognized this when he launched Plan YC in 2007. The plan recognized that cities are in a global marketplace, and that if we're going to continue to grow and thrive and to attract the million more people that are expected to move here, we need to focus on the quality of life and the efficiency of our infrastructure. For many cities, our streets have been in a kind of suspended animation for generations. Not much has changed in 50 years.
And what Jeanette means by that is that for the past 50 years, city streets have been designed to cater to cars and not to people. And in most cities today,
you see people on the street, you know, huddled on medians and sidewalks, you know, just jostling to get around.
So when she took the job with Mayor Bloomberg, Jeanette started to think about how she can make the city more like it was before cars took over, when pedestrians had space to walk and shop and take a break in between.
When we started out, we did some early surveys about how our streets were used. And we found that New York City was largely a city without seats. You know, pictures like this, people perched on a fire hydrant, not the mark of a world-class city. So we worked hard to change that balance. And probably the best example of our new approach is in Times Square. 350,000 people a day walk through Times Square. And people had tried for years to make changes. It was dangerous, hard to cross the street. It was chaotic. And so we took a different approach, a bigger approach, looked at our street differently. We closed Broadway from 42nd Street to 47th Street and created 2.5 acres of new pedestrian space.
And we just took paint and planters and tried it out. And lo and behold, it was a big home run. Traffic flowed better, and it was safer, and it worked better for business. It's now one of the top 10 retail locations on the planet, which certainly wasn't the case before.
So you did this with just some paint and, like, orange cones and chairs, and that was it?
Yes, you can move fast. And, you know, a lot of people think that transportation or economic development starts with something. It's like a new building or a tech hub or a new subway line. And these usually take billions of dollars to create. But I think changing your city starts with something even more basic, which is rethinking your streets. And it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. And I think that's a really compelling strategy for mayors around the world.
We also brought this quick-acting approach to our cycling program. And in 6 years, turned cycling into a real transportation option in New York. I think it's fair to say it used to be a fairly scary place to ride a bike. And now New York has become one of the cycling capitals in the United States. And we moved quickly to create an interconnected network of 350 miles of on-street bike lanes. We also brought new designs to the street. We created the first parking-protected bike lane in the United States. We protected bikers by floating parking lanes, and it's been great. Bike volumes have spiked. Injuries to all users, pedestrians, cyclists, drivers, are all down 50%. We've built 30 miles of these protected bike lanes, and now you're seeing them pop up all over the country. This summer, we launched City Bike, the largest bike share program in the United States, with 6,000 bikes and 330 stations located next to one another. Since we've launched the program, 3 million trips have been taken. People have ridden 7 million miles. That's 280 times around the globe. And so with this little blue key, you can unlock the keys to the city and this brand new transportation option.
So looking at the different ways to make it easier for people to bike, whether it's setting up a bike infrastructure, whether it's making it possible for them to park their bike once they get there, or developing a bike share system so that you didn't have to have a bike or worry about parking it when you were getting around town.
You know, like in a place like Copenhagen, right? I mean, I think like 50% of the people commute by bike, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder, I mean, is that realistic for most cities? I mean, could you achieve that everywhere? Or can you just do that in a place like Copenhagen?
No, I think that people, you know, when you build it, they will come. You know, we've seen a quadrupling of bike commuting in New York City since 2000. And, you know, while that's happened, there's been no change in the number of serious bike crashes in New York. So that's a 75% drop in risk. And so a lot of the work goes into building that safe infrastructure. And I think, you know, you've seen biking explode.
Do you think, though, that at some point, even if bike lanes and pedestrian zones and public transit isn't as prioritized as highways and roads, that the reality is just going to change that equation, that the reality of what's happening in urban spaces is going to mean that those other things are going to have to be prioritized?
Yeah, I think so. And we are in a global competition. You know, businesses and people can move anywhere. So it really, changing how your streets are designed is a matter of economic competitiveness. It's a development strategy. And when you can show that it's better for safety, it's better for business, it's better for health, you know, those kinds of strategies are going to be the kind of strategies that make a city sing and soar and compete well. So it's really like back to the future. You know, I mean, prioritizing pedestrian movement now is something that cities are looking at. Streetcars are having a huge comeback. You're seeing a lot of buses come back with bus rapid transit. And, of course, bikes, you know, one of the oldest modes of getting around that there is. And so making New York City with 8.4 million people today work even better for the million that are expected to come here by 2030 means that you can't just wait for it. You can't just expect that it's going to work. You have to plan for that future, and you have to design the city you want to see.
That's Jeanette Sadik-Khan. She's now working with Bloomberg Associates, advising other cities on how to change their streets as well. You can check out her full talk at ted.npr.org. So innovations often come out of really irritating experiences, you know, like not being able to get to where you need to go quickly or efficiently. In one afternoon in 1977, that happened to Richard Branson in Puerto Rico.
I was 27 years old. I had a beautiful lady waiting for me in the Virgin Islands, and the airline that I was flying on decided they didn't have enough passengers, so they decided to delay the flight till the next morning. And I was upset, desperate to get to this lady. And I went to the back of the airport, I rented a plane, got a blackboard, just for a joke, wrote Virgin Airlines, since I was going to the Virgin Islands, went out to all the passengers who'd been bumped and filled my first plane. And we ended up getting to the BVI that night, and it got me thinking. Next day I rang up Boeing and said, have you got any secondhand 747s for sale?
You know, you made this move that a lot of people advised you was crazy. And in fact,
this is TED curator Chris Anderson in conversation with Richard on the TED stage.
I had a conversation with one of the investment bankers who, at the time when you basically sold your Virgin Records and invested heavily in Virgin Atlantic, and his view was that you were trading, you know, the world's fourth biggest record company for the 25th biggest airline, and that you were out of your mind. Why did you do that?
Well, I think that there's a very thin dividing line between success and failure. And I think if you start a business without financial backing, you're likely to go the wrong side of that dividing line. And I just love learning, and I'm incredibly inquisitive, and I love taking on the status quo and trying to turn it upside down. So I've seen life as one long learning process, and if I see if I fly on somebody else's airline and find the experience is not a pleasant one, which it wasn't 21 years ago, then I think, well, you know, maybe I can create the kind of airline that I'd like to fly on.
And the kind of airline that had personal video players and libraries and a standing bar 20 years before any other airline did the same thing. But aside from those things, the thing about flying is that it's not that different than it was 60 years ago. So Richard Branson plans to change that. And just like Bertrand Piccard, the seed was planted on a particular July day in 1969.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
It was watching the moon landing on a little black and white television set.
You're looking good here.
And with my sisters and parents. And that was the most inspirational moment of those years.
Did you think at that moment that we'll all someday go there? I'll go there. We'll be up there.
Oh, absolutely felt that. And I think, you know, millions of people all over the world assumed that one day we would be able to go to the moon.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States.
And that was inspirational. And you know, many, many, many years later, only 300 or 400 people had actually been into space. And it was obvious that governments weren't that interested in letting us experience the wonders of space. And then we decided, let's get out there and try to find an engineer or somewhere in the world who could build us a spaceship.
So that's exactly what Richard Branson did.
5, 4, 3, 2... Release.
What you're hearing right now is actual audio from one of the first ever test flights of Spaceship Two.
7, 8 seconds.
It's a new kind of spacecraft that was built by Virgin Galactic, which is Richard's commercial spaceflight company.
5 seconds to go.
And it works like this. There's a giant rocket ship that blasts you and 5 other passengers to an altitude of 60,000 feet, at which point the smaller capsule that you're inside... detaches.
Release.
And then there's another rocket blast.
Armed. Fire.
And then you're pressed back into your seat at 3,000 miles per hour. And you're taken thousands of feet higher.
God, sweet air.
Into space.
Bring it down. Down by. Feather up.
When the rocket stops, you will be in space. There'll be complete silence. You will unbuckle, and you will float around, just gently lift up and hit the roof, and you'll be able to turn somersaults, and you'll be able to look out of big windows that we've built back at our beautiful Earth, and you'll be one of only 500 people have been to space, and you will have had, the ride of a lifetime.
Richard Branson has already sold over 700 tickets for these future flights, each one costing $250,000. And once those 700 people go up, that'll be more than all the people who've ever been to space, period. How is this going to change how we travel around the world in the future?
Well, it'll take us a while, but the 300 engineers that are working on this project are already drawing up designs for transcontinental aeroplanes. I mean, on purpose, we built our spaceship shaped as an aeroplane rather than shaped as a rocket, which is the conventional way. And in that way, we can build them bigger and bigger. And one day, we hope to be able to transport you orbitally, i.e. at 18,000 miles an hour from, say, New York to Australia. The maximum amount of time that people should actually spend traveling is, you know, roughly 40 minutes, because
wow,
at 18,000 miles an hour, you can get to pretty well anywhere on Earth in about 40 minutes. But equally, I think that through space travel, we may well be able to reduce the carbon footprint to a negligible carbon footprint in traveling people around the world by, you know, getting them out of the Earth's atmosphere and orbitally around the world. Anyway, all Virgin flights. we'll see whether the others catch us up.
So this is really probably going to be the next big innovation in flight, right? Like now we've got, obviously, jet travel, and the Concorde was around for a while, but it's more or less the same amount of time to get from New York to Tokyo. But the big change is going to be when you've got aircraft that will launch into space and then come back down.
Yes. I mean, that's going to be the radical change, and then it's up to our engineers and technicians to overcome the technological challenge, then to make sure that it is environmentally safe. Maybe the most iconic picture ever, which has done more, I think, for the environmental movement than almost any other picture, was the picture shot from the moon back off the Earth. And I think that picture stimulated so many of us to want to, you know, protect our oceans, to protect the species in our oceans, to protect the forests, to protect the species in our forests. And if we can actually get thousands of people to have that experience, I think that will be enormously beneficial to the world. You know, it's what sort of science fiction's made of. You'll be able to just sit back and look out of your window at the Earth as you're traveling around it, and it's going to be absolutely breathtaking.
That's Richard Branson. In late May, Virgin Galactic was cleared for takeoff by the FAA. Richard plans to be on that first flight to space with both of his kids later this year. He's a pretty fascinating guy, so you should check out his full interview on the TED stage with Chris Anderson at TED.com.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around, I get around.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show, Getting There. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, check out ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Rund Abdel Fattah, Daniel Shukin, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.